There's some formal stuff we not to go, have to go through. So this is your succession plan. This is what it looks like. And for those of you who are aspiring advisors, as I identified earlier, it looks like that. But more importantly, here's what it looks like. There are a number of steps to it. And I put this one first, preparing yourself financially. And I'll dig into these more on an individual basis. Most advisors, or many advisors, because of the comment, relative to the comments I made this morning about a lifestyle practice, basically having little value, are not prepared financially to exit their transition to practice. The emotional preparation, I also talked about those soft issues, is really important. I put them in this order because my experience is, and I'm sure yours would be the same with clients, the better prepared we are financially, the more favorable emotionally we are disposed to doing something. So the more money I have to fund my retirement lifestyle, the more anxious or willing at least I'll be to do it. We do have to drive some stakes in the ground around timing. As I said earlier today, succession is a process. It's not an event. There's no abrupt transition normally. But that doesn't mean we can't have some points of reference. And so I'll give you some ideas on that. And then selecting the best exit plan, there are a number of options that people can follow or choose to follow. I'll tell you which ones are most popular and what's involved in them. And then choosing your successor, drafting the plan, implementing the plan, monitoring it and revising it. With our time limitation this morning, I'm only going to be able to talk about the first four steps. Whoops. But quite frankly, if we get those right, then the rest will work too. I wonder if there's a volume control in this. I don't think so. I'll stick it in my pocket. So we'll do that. And if we get time, I'm happy to answer questions on any of the others. So the first one then is preparing yourself financially. And so my question would be, have you ever encountered an experience with a client where their perception of how much money they needed in retirement was different than yours? Happens all the time, right? Well, guess what? Financial advisors are no different. And for a whole bunch of reasons that we'll point out, there's a difference between perception and reality. And that comes about, in many cases, in these lifestyle practices, where an advisor has gone out and built a big practice and they're maybe generating, $400,000 a year of revenue. And they're going to go out and sell that practice at some point. And they might think they're going to get 2x revenue or something like that. That's 2 years of income to them. And if they have no personal assets to back that up, then they're going to have to alter their lifestyle significantly. All right. So their perception is very different as well. So one of the questions we have to ask in determining whether or not we are individually prepared financially to exit or transition the business, do I have assets outside of my practice? When I do sell my practice, is it going to generate enough cash or income for me to have the lifestyle I want? What guarantees do I need? As I said earlier today, very few practices trade hands for 100% cash up front. So there's almost always some earn-out payment. And what guarantees do you need to have associated with that? They're often backed by personal notes from the purchaser and so on, and often financed by the vendor. So what interest rate guarantees, what guarantee of payment, what penalty, all of those things have to figure into this. And then one of the big ones is, can I get along without the perks? How about all those things that I enjoy because, A, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm self-employed, but also just because this industry tends to lead us that way. So those perks are things like, going on vacation and writing it off as a conference, having your nanny on the payroll. I've seen all these things. Those $4 Starbucks designer coffees that you have every morning right off as entertainment expense. Those sorts of things. Right? So lots of perks come with this. And when you no longer have the business, they're not available to you. So the big question is, and the first step in the process from my perspective, is figure out what your number is. Now, you've probably all read the book, Your Number. I think that's what it's called. But basically what it says is, how much capital do you need at retirement in order to fund the lifestyle you want? What personal assets do you have? And the difference between those, between what the capital you require and the personal assets you've got, is the value you would like to sell your practice for which you would like to sell your practice. So the target value of the practice. You have to start with some sort of a baseline, so I'd always encourage advisors to get some sort of practice valuation done. Doesn't have to be deep, but it gets some idea realistically of what the practice is worth. Because if you've got the current value and you've got the target value, you subtract one from the other, you end up with the gap. You end up with the amount of money or the extra value in your practice that you have to create. Now, does this look any different than the work you do with clients? No, it's exactly the same, right? What's the objective? What do you want your retirement to look like? What's the current situation today? And then how do we close the gap between today and tomorrow? So that's exactly the same process. So we measure financial freedom, as I call it, financial capability, perhaps a better description, in a continuum. Because you know, not everyone can say I need X number of dollars to retire, or that I need to sell my practice for X number of dollars to deem it successful. So on the low end of the scale, if you you're one of the aspiring advisors who are looking to move into a practice, you've got to look at the vendor, the potential vendor, and ask these questions. Are there investments outside the business? If there are little or no investments, if the lifestyle depends entirely on how well the practice is doing, if the business pays a lot of your personal expenses, and you fully need to sell the business in order to fund retirement, then you'd be on the low end of that financial readiness curve. In a little bit higher up, you've got some personal assets that you can add to the value of the business for practice today more than supports your lifestyle. You don't need to spend all the money. Your financial needs are not onerous, and you're looking for the sale to only fund part of your retirement. That's a better position, obviously, than the one on the left. At the high end of the scale would be where you've got substantial personal assets outside the business. You don't even need to sell it at all for your lifestyle in retirement. And quite frankly, what's more important to you is how the clients are going to be treated and how they're going to be managed after you're gone. Far more important than the money. Step number two, I love this little guy. Your emotional enthusiasm, right? What's your passion for actually doing this? Right? How much of your energy, and I talked about this briefly this morning as well, comes from your role as an advisor? If that's what sparks you, if that's what gets you out of bed in the morning and drives you, right, then you're going to miss that. Right? That's not going to be there anymore. And so how are you going to cope with that? And if your entire life, if you're defined, as I said earlier today too, by your business, that's a tough one to overcome. Are you going to be okay with somebody else doing your job? Now, for those of you who live in smaller communities in particular, this can be a problem. You know, you're 6 months after you've transitioned out of the business, you're walking down the street, and you bump into one of your old clients. And they say, you know, can I just talk to you for a minute? Let me ask for your advice about what this advisor that's taking over your practice is suggesting I do. How are you going to respond to that? Right? Are you going to say, well, tell me more, because you want to be involved? Or are you going to say, well, really, you know, we chose that successor carefully. I'm sure the advice is sound. Or somewhere in between. All right. So how are you going to deal with the advice? And what if they tell you what the advice is and it turns out that you think it's wrong and you don't like it? Are you going to try to correct it in some way? So how are you going to be with that? Will you miss the action? One of the fun things about being in our industry is there's lots of stuff going on, right? There are political events, there are economic events, there are regulatory events. We watch the markets on a daily basis if we're in the investment side of the business and so on. There's a lot of stuff going on that kind of energizes us. And again, if I no longer have to get up in the morning and turn the radio on to find out how the overseas stock markets did, then I might miss that kind of pulse as well. Will I miss the people, the clients, the staff, the people that I meet at these kind of conferences or symposiums? Your company conferences that you go to, right? If you're no longer there or part of that organization, then you might miss that, you know, annual trip with 600 of your best friends. And then, will I miss the public profile? It's not uncommon for financial advisors to be big men on campus, so to speak, in their communities. They're successful business people. They earn a good income. They support community causes. The community often comes to them for assistance in social or charitable activities, because they're successful business plan people, because they can strategize, because they can keep an account of books, and so on. So are you going to miss that? And then the big one that I mentioned earlier today, what am I going to retire to? What am I going to do? If I don't have anything else to do, then that becomes really hard for me to ever imagine. Right? We can only play so much golf or garden so much. You're barely going to replace all of the excitement, thrill, energy you got from your work. But it has to be something that's attractive to you. So similarly, as we did with financial capability, we look at emotional enthusiasm on a continuum as well. On the low end, as I said, again, it's an existential question. If you're totally defined by your business and you no longer have your business, who are you? So that's on the low end. If you feel genuinely the business couldn't run without me, you know, if I wasn't there every day, things would just go completely awry. I couldn't live without those perks and the recognition. Those perks that I talked about, the community respecting me the way they do, and I have no idea what I'd do next. Then you're on the low end of the emotional enthusiasm scale. If you, in fact, however, have a life outside your business, you have other hobbies, other interests, and so on, then you're probably in a much better position. If you'd like to spend more time doing something else, whether it be family, community, write a book, read a book, whatever it might be, you've got a good team in place and you're content with what you've done, then you're probably, well, we know for sure, you're much better emotionally prepared. And at the high end, we have those people who can't wait to get out of the business. Now, in an ideal world, we hope that's because they have something else they're really passionate about and they want to pursue. But if it's because they're just fed up, right, suffering from what I call illness and fatigue, and sick and tired of this, right, I don't want to do this for the next 15 years, then you should probably get a high emotional motivation to exit the business. On the other hand, if you're very proud of what you've done and you really are interested in coaching and mentoring someone else, which I beg you to do, the industry needs more coaches and mentors among its veteran advisors to help the younger people get solidly established. So that would be the continuum there. So what we do, because I'm a bit of an analytical guy, and this actually came up in a book many years ago by John Leonetti out of Boston called Exiting Your Business, Protecting Your Wealth. He wasn't talking about financial advisors, but it's a sound concept anyway. So we have a matrix, right? We have financial dimension on the bottom and emotional on the vertical. And I colored them intentionally red, yellow, and green to indicate the level of risk associated with them. In the bottom left corner, low emotional readiness, low financial capability, then you're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. Right? You can't leave because you can't afford it, and you're not ready to anyway, even if you could afford it. So you're going to be there for a while. So we're going to have to do something to make the best of it while you were there. On the other hand, if you're in the top right-hand corner, emotionally ready to transition, financially capable, then you have lots of options, lots of options. The other two I colored yellow for a caution. High emotional readiness to lead, but not financially able to support the lifestyle I want. And we have seen that all too often when someone has a high emotional desire to get out of the business, they sell their practice for not enough money, and then 2 or 3 years later they regret it because their lifestyle isn't what they want it to be. Down on the bottom right-hand corner, low emotional and high financial. I could leave if I wanted to from a financial perspective, but I'm just not ready. That's actually a healthier place to be than the other yellow box. Okay, step number three, set your target date. Again, although I said earlier we don't have a specific date we circle on the calendar typically, it is important to drive some stakes in the ground. And I'd suggest you set 2 dates. All right, and again, these don't have to be chiseled in stone either, but at least give us some frame of reference. So the first date I call the earliest possible date. This is the date when you'll be somewhat financially prepared, when you have a plan in place, and ideally you've identified your successor. So the earliest possible. This doesn't mean you're going to leave at that point. It just means that if you had to or if you chose to, you could. Earliest possible. The second date is the latest acceptable. And this is the date when you are emotionally prepared. It's often driven from the emotional side rather than you say, look, I'm prepared to do this, but only for the next 5 years or 10 years or whatever it might be. Right? So you're emotionally ready. You've got concerns about things or issues around other things that you'd like to spend time on. You don't want to wait too long. You don't want to wait until your health deteriorates, for example, if there are some things that you want to pursue that require good health. You might have a hobby that you are enjoying today and you want to spend more time at, but if you wait until you're 70 years old, you won't be able to do it. Right, so you might consider that. And you might have family issues. You might have family growing up that you want to spend more time with. You might have family out of the house at a certain time and you want to travel with your spouse or whatever. And then the final thing to consider in here, in this particular one, is the marketability of your business. What practice would sell for more? One with an average client age of 70 or one with an average client age of 50? 50, clearly, right? Lots more opportunity for the buyer to build additional business. So you've got to look at this. If your current average age of clients is 65 and you say, I'm going to work for another 10 years, by then your current average age is going to be 75, unless you've got some strong program to bring younger people in underneath them. So your practice, the marketability of it, the appeal of it, the value of it will diminish as your client base ages. So you have to decide how far out you can still have a practice which will be attractive to other people. So we go back to our matrix. Given what I've just described, then, if you're on the low left-hand side, low financial, low emotional, then we got to go to work. We have to do some things to increase both dimensions. So there are strategies, of course, you can follow to increase the value of your business. You can grow your business. You can increase the percentage of recurring revenue and things I'll talk about in just a moment. But this is a period of work, and that's all there is to it. It's not going to magically be worth more. You're just going to have to grind it out. Now, hopefully, you find a way to work smarter so you don't have to just work harder. And you work to increase your emotional enthusiasm. And as I said earlier, the good news about that is that usually when the finances improve, so does the emotional perception. And so if we work really hard to increase the value of the business, then we'll become increasingly emotionally ready to exit. If you're in the top left corner, and you are emotionally ready, anxious to get out of the business, but not financially prepared, then you got to work quickly. You got to do some things that'll beef up the value of the business in a hurry so you can sell it. In the extreme case, and I've seen this when people, as I said, are just sick and tired and worn out, and they want to get out of the business, then sell the business to the highest bidder. All right? There's always somebody around who'd be willing to buy it. You may not like them for the reasons I cited earlier, but sell the business and get out. Better for you, your health, better for the clients, they'll be serviced by someone who wants to service them, better for your dealer firm, better for the industry all around. And that increasing the value quickly is not necessarily easy to do. So that one is a little trickier, a little harder to manage. But it can be done. There are ways to do that. One of the ways that you do that is through acquisition. You go out and buy another book of business. Not because you really want to have another book of business, but because we know that larger practices sell for higher multiples than smaller practices. And so if I've got, and I'll just use investment assets as a measure, if I've got a $50 million book of investment assets and I can add another 25 through an acquisition, I'll get a higher multiple on a $75 million book than I will on a $50 million book. All other things being equal, of course. Down in this corner.
Are there kind of like benchmarks where I need to around $50 million? I mean, is there a big difference between 50 and 75 or 100 million?
There's not much difference at the lower levels, right? So like under 20.
Under $50 million.
Yeah, under 20 million. 20 to 50, maybe a little bit higher. 50 to 100 and 100 and above.
So 100 and above is really your...
100 and above is kind of the bogey up there.
Okay.
Yeah. Unlike many other industries where, the multiple increases, this doesn't increase quite as dramatically. In the software industry, for example, and I know this because I'm on the board of a software company, a small private software company, that does about $5 million of revenue, and we're working on a succession plan there. And there's no successor in the firm. There's nobody around. So we're going to sell the company. We put it out on the market today. It would sell for about 4 times revenue. If we get it to 10 million, it sells for 6 times revenue. So that's a big jump. So what are we doing? We're going out and buying another company that also has 5 million, putting them together. We're going to sell the $10 million company.
What with the financial firms, what's times revenue, with each of those chairs?
I'm going to come back and talk about that. Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. Make sure I do answer it. So over on this side, if you're financially ready, you don't have to exit, so you can take your time. And as I said earlier, this might be the opportunity to coach or mentor that person into take your place. Now, I said we weren't going to talk about choosing a successor. This might be a point at least to mention, and we can come back and talk about it in more detail, about bringing family members into the business. It's almost every entrepreneur's dream to have their family carry on the family business. There are lots of reasons why that's a good idea, and there are lots of reasons why it's a bad idea. And so in many cases that we see, it's this, you know, we always say sell your business to the most qualified buyer. And often the child is not the most qualified buyer. Right? And often they don't want to be there. And in my book, I write about an instance, it's a real life case in Buffalo, where the parents were both involved in the business, substantial life insurance practice, top of the table producer, had a son who graduated from college and come in work in the business. Their full expectation was he would take it over. And so we were doing a coaching session together. I was in Buffalo, and we all went out to dinner. And they said, tonight, just, you know, talk to him and tell him what a great opportunity we're giving him. And so we did. You know, we started that conversation, and I could tell he just wasn't into it. His enthusiasm wasn't anywhere near his parents. And so I had to stop, and I said, tell me honestly, do you want to take over your parents' business? And it was dead silence. Right? And then finally he said, no. He said, I want to be an airline pilot. Right? And the parents were shocked. They'd assumed for years that he would automatically assume ownership of the business. And so, you know, they pushed back a little bit, and he said, well, that's what you want, the business. And sometimes children will accept that out of an obligation to the parents. And then you have just, you know, within 2 to 3 years, that business would be gone, is my experience. So, top right-hand corner, as I said, because you're prepared both emotionally and financially, you can do anything you want. Leave when you want, stay, find, coach, mentor someone, bring a sibling, or a child into the business, whatever you choose to do. Okay, next step is to look at the actual options that are available to you. And they basically boil down to three, right? You can carry on doing what you're doing, you can sell the business, or you can transfer it to someone else. All right, and for the aspiring advisors, as I keep referring to you, in the business, recognize that these are basically the options. And there are some that obviously appeal differently to different people. But those are them. I spread them out a little bit more. The first option is the same option you have whenever you're faced with a decision, and that's to do nothing. All right? And if you do nothing, I call this the die in the saddle approach. Right? That's where, you know, you walk by the glass-fronted office, and you see the person's been sitting there in the same position for 3 days with the same clothes on, and there's this peculiar odor coming out from under the door, and they basically died on the job. Right? And we've seen that. Didn't take 3 days, but we've actually seen a case where it took several hours for someone to notice that someone sitting behind their desk had actually passed away. And without a succession plan. But that's the first option. I don't like that one very much. But surprisingly, as you saw earlier, it is a favorite option of a lot of advisors because they are not planning on having any sort of succession strategy. Right. Second option is just to carry on. So if the first one is kind of that die in the saddle approach, the second one is ride off into the sunset. Right? And this is the one where people notice that you're gradually riding away, but they never really see you disappear. And then ultimately, and then surprisingly, one day you're gone. And a lot of advisors take that approach as well. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing until I can't do it anymore, or the business isn't strong enough to support me, and then I'm just going to fade away. All right? And John Homer and I were talking over lunch about the fact, you know, when I've built 3 books of business throughout my career, never sold any one of them. All right? Those days, you didn't sell books of business. You basically gave them to your buddy. Here are my clients, look after them, please, and you went on to do whatever you were doing next. Right? Today's world, you create real economic value in a practice. And so as either a buyer or a seller, I have to recognize that value and be willing to trade on that value. So that's number two. The third option is what I call the partial exit. And this is the one where you basically say, I'm going to take the top 20 clients, I'm going to work with those, I'm going to give the rest to my junior, or I'm going to sell off the rest to an associate or whatever it might be, and I'm just going to keep my hand in the game by working with my top 20 clients. Right? Probably the number one favorite choice of advisors today. is to do this. Right? It allows that gradual transition and so on. The fourth one is an internal transfer. That's where there's someone else in your firm, your office, to whom with whom you make a deal to for them to acquire your client base over time. This one also usually starts in as a contingency plan. A contingency plan is the deal you've got with the person in the office next door that says, listen, if I die, you take over my clients. If you die, I take over your clients. Right? It's not formalized in a succession plan, but it often is the foundation of a succession plan. If you think, oh, well, I'm going to let this person take over my business if I die, then they should probably take over my business when I retire too. Where that becomes a real problem, we've seen this so often, is where you've got two 65-year-olds making the same deal. All right? And it's not gaining any advantage from a succession standpoint. So internal transfer, and internal transfer, quite frankly, is the one that's best for clients. Least disruptive, less paperwork, and you know, they don't have to learn new systems and all that sort of stuff. The external sale is the one that gets the most press. Everyone talks about selling your business for X multiples or whatever. And you sell to a competitor, you'll almost always get more than if you sold internally. Because, particularly today, when it's a seller's market, we can create competitive bidding. All right? And I can't work in your market area, but I know in my market area in Canada, if an advisor called me and said, look, I'm ready to sell my business, I've got $50 million of assets under management, I could have four or five buyers lined up within about 48 hours for them. And they would start bidding competitively. And the price would go up, and clients sit back and say, well, this is wonderful. Right? Again, may not be the type of buyer that you want if you had more time, but in a pinch, you could certainly sell a business in a hurry.
George?
Yeah?
I just have a question. In that scenario, yep. Do you charge a fee, and what do you charge, or how do you handle that?
When we're doing that?
Say an external acquisition.
We do charge a fee. Do you want to know the fee? I don't mind telling. And I think your rules are fairly similar here, but you know, vendors always want to sell shares, right? Because they can get some capital gains exemption. Buyers always want to buy assets because they don't want the liabilities that come with owning the shares. So how that transacts depends entirely on the situation. Yeah. Okay, so this is kind of a summary of what I've just talked about, just described. A little pointer on here.
Here, what?
Oh, that wasn't what I wanted. That's what I wanted. So the do-nothing, number one option, has a big advantage in that you don't need a succession plan. Right?
It's got its own succession.
Yeah, it's got its own succession plan, right? It's just going to happen. But it doesn't need a succession plan. The big challenge, of course, is you're unlikely to get full value for your business. All right, because it's uncertain, that's not likely to happen. Now, option number two, carrying on. Again, no succession plan required. And I have to tell you, there are a number of situations where we actually recommend this to advisors. You know, we'll do a valuation, and we'll come in and say, look, you know, quite frankly, your business isn't worth much without you there. And so if you're going to leave, you know, you're not going to get a whole lot of money for it. And buyers are becoming smarter about that. So I will say, look, we could sell your business today for 2x revenue, let's say. I'll just use that as an example. But, you know, if you just run it out for the next 3 or 5 years, you'll get 3x or 3.5x or something like that. All right? So sometimes we have to say to them, it's not the best option to sell your business. The problem with that is, of course, the timing is uncertain for you and everybody else. But also clients begin to get nervous about this. You know, as I said earlier, if you don't think your clients are already talking about your retirement, they are, right? If you're old enough, not for the gentleman here at the front, but for the rest of the world, yeah, they're asking questions. If they haven't voiced them to you, they're having those conversations either among themselves or with others. And some of your competitors might also be prompting that question. And I'm betting that most of you, if not all of you, built your business on referrals today. So they become less. So, you know, if you've got good, strong referral sources, CPAs and attorneys and all of those people, if they're not sure you're going to be there, they're going to be reluctant to put their name next to yours as a referral source. The partial exit does allow you to keep your hand in the game. If you focus on those high-value clients, normally an advisor says they're going to do this, well, I'm going to carve out the top 20 or 25 clients, and I'm just going to work with them. I'll only have to work 3 days a week. These are people I like, and besides that, they generate enough money to support my lifestyle. Everyone's familiar with Pareto's principle, the 80-20 rule. 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your clients. It's worse than that, because we've done a lot of analytics on this. 100% of the profitability of your business comes from the top 20 clients, right? In almost every case. 20 clients on the average practice account for all the profitability. Right? Everybody else just kind of is there, costs you money. So what happens if you take the top 20 clients out of the practice? There's nothing left, right? There's an unprofitable business left, and if you hand that to the successor, they're going to struggle with it. Right?
Can you do that where that unprofitable block of business is handed to the successor with an agreement where any business that comes out of it is going to be split in some way?
Absolutely, yeah.
And when you do that, is it a constant split that stays the same through the years, or is it like 50-50 on business that happens in the first year and 40-60 and,
Yeah, can work that way. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that, and your point is a good one, John, that, you know, if you've got a good second advisor there that can come in and work that block of business, you know, just because they're not your A clients, they could become their A clients. And so they can actually build a very, I wish when I started out, some advisor had come along to me and said, here's 200 of my worst clients. You know, take them. I would have been wonderful. It would have saved me a lot of dialing for dollars and all that other stuff.
George, what age differential do you recommend? If an advisor is 65, does he look for somebody that's been in the business, you know, 10, 15 years, that's 20 years his junior? Speaking for myself, I have a branch office in downtown LA.
Yeah, so it's circumstantial, right? If I'm 65 and I want out in 5 years, let's say, all right, so I'm going to be 70. I can't hand my practice over to a 30-year-old because the clients won't relate as well. Right? So yes, I'm going to want someone that's 45 or 50 in there. So I want them to have sufficient length of time in the industry to improve their capability, but I don't want them to be so close in age to me that they're only going to be my successor for 5 years. Right? That's not fair to the clients. On the other hand, if I'm 60 years old, even 55, and I'm planning my succession, I like to see, you know, in most cases, at least 10-year difference in age, I would say. Okay, so that has the risk of ripping all the value from the practice, and it also means that those clients that you choose not to work with, that you hand off to someone else, will find out about it, and so they want to know. So what we usually do in that situation is we say, okay, you know, we've set up a communication plan Michael? Yeah. So Michael's joining our practice, and he's going to take on some of the client relationships. He's eminently qualified. He's a great guy. We really trust and like him. And so from this point forward, and we do this in different language, but from this point forward, Michael's going to be your primary point of contact. However, if you ever feel the need to talk to me, by all means, I'm happy to be there. And I'm going to work with Michael to try to introduce him, to try to build his credibility and strengthen the relationship that he has with the clients. So eventually they don't call me. They just call Michael. Right? So that whole transition process, I can't remember which is right. So that whole thing, process?
We understood them both.
Okay, good.
You can do both here in Utah.
All right. So that whole thing, the whole transition effort is a topic unto itself. How do you communicate with clients that you're leaving? Right? They've been wondering about it. They're worried about it in some cases. So you want to do it as an event, as a celebratory event, or a celebratory transition, I hate to tell you, but I'm retiring. So the more advanced notice you can give clients, which means having your successor in place, the better they will feel about it, the more loyal they will be to the new advisor, improve your retention, and so on. So there are strategies for doing that as well. All right, I don't know why this says number three. That's not right. Internal transfer, as I said earlier, is the easiest to arrange, least disruptive for clients, and in some organizations there's actually financing available. Some broker-dealer firms and others will finance the purchase of a book of business. Now, the challenge in doing that is that you may not get the full value, because often when they finance those purchases, they do it according to their formula, which is may turn out to be less than what you get in the marketplace if you went out. And then the biggest problem, as I mentioned earlier this morning as well, is that there may not be a suitable candidate close by within your practice or within your branch or even within your firm. If you're in a small organization or small community where you're the only advisor, for example, or there might be one other person and they're as old and grumpy as you are, you may not have an obvious choice. Though you want to transfer it internally, and the firm would certainly like to keep the business, it just may not work. You have the other opposite situation where you can have too many people vying for the book of business. I referenced that this morning. And they start fighting internally over who should get it. And I know advisors who just do not want to get into that conversation. The external sale, as I mentioned, is the one most likely to maximize the value. It's the most disruptive to clients. They have to change. There's a whole bunch of paperwork to change dealerships. They have to get used to new statements, new systems, all kinds of things that happen. And in some cases, particularly among some of the career shops, you just may not be able to. They're not your clients. You can't sell them. I never liked the idea of selling clients anyway. I think we stopped doing that about 100 years ago, selling people. What we're really selling, of course, is the cash flow that comes from our client base. So all of those reasons, that's important to pick one. All right, and pick the one that makes most sense to you.
I have a question. If you are in a position where your contract prohibits it, and I hope this doesn't sound like a stupid question, but is there anything that you can do to try to, most companies will allow you to maybe bring a family member in or somebody that they like or whatever. What would you suggest that somebody do to kind of position themselves if they are in that?
Well, if they're in that position, then the ideal thing would be for you to get to choose the successor. And if it's a family member, that's great. If it's a good friend and a good buddy, you can work some deal. What happens most often in that case is it's a very tenuous or a very tightrope type thing to walk, is that the advisor will leave and hope the clients follow. At the end of the day, the clients get to decide, right? But you have to be very careful that you're not accused of soliciting the clients and so on. There's lots of lawsuits around this. But increasingly, and I'm assuming it's very similar here in the U.S., most of the independent broker-dealers, at least in Canada, now have clauses that you own the clients. You decide to leave, you take them with you. And they're using that for recruiting competitive purposes. So that's a harder one.
George, does that tend to be with just your independent broker-dealers versus your insurance company BDs?
No, the insurance company BDs are pretty much the same, but there's still a few career agencies around and stuff like that. You can't. And we have the retail brokerage industry in Canada is dominated by bank-owned firms. We have about 6 major banks that all have very large brokerage. And they're all treated as employees, and the clients all belong to the bank. So they get into real hassles when they leave. And it's a real hassle because each bank is out there trying to recruit from the other one, and they're bringing large checkbooks. And so they're waving $1 million checks in front of advisors to say, come over. But their contract prohibits them from soliciting. So they've got some mechanisms and some processes and midnight movers and all kinds of things in there to move the clients over. So, and this is, again, this emphasizes the point that this is not something you can approach lightly or in a short period of time. You have to plan it. You have to anticipate what could go wrong with it and have a plan B and C, I would even suggest. Okay, I didn't want to spend a whole bunch of time crunching numbers on, but I think we need to talk about valuation of practice. How much time do we have left?
15?
Okay, lots of time. So I don't want to do this unless you want. We can dig into this, and I could actually show you a real valuation. You'd see it. But for those of you who are really interested in the numbers, there's the formula that we use to value practices. Any mathematicians or actuaries in the room? Right? You would immediately recognize the formula. The value of a practice is the sum of cash flow over a period of time adjusted for risk. All right, that's what the formula says. So think about it. How do you calculate the commuted value of an annuity? You discount it back to present value by applying the interest rate that's associated with it, with the annuity, right? That's how you bring it back to present value. This is precisely the same. When we value a practice, we look at the future cash flow, and then we discount that back based on, we can't use a simple interest rate. It's actually calculated as an interest rate, but we can't just look at it and say, well, cash flow earns 6%. That's not true. So we have to discount it back according to the risk factor. And the risk is determined in two ways. And I'll talk about this in a bit, but it's determined the specific risk of investing, or the risk of investing in a practice at all today, right? And the, plus the specific risk of investing in your practice. So if you evaluate Ford Motor Company, you're going to invest in Ford Motor Company, you would look at what's the risk of investing in equity markets today, and then what's the risk of investing in Ford as part of that equity market. So it's exactly the same thing. What's the risk of investing in a financial advisory practice? What's the risk of investing in yours? All right.
So how do you factor in persistency as far as...
It's one of the factors.
As soon as you transfer... Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the factors. So we look at, and I'm on an ongoing retainer contract with one of the life insurance companies in Canada, and they're going around, they're buying up the books of business of all their retiring advisors, or about to retire advisors. And so I'm doing all the valuations. Right? The good thing about the life insurance industry is you've got persistency numbers. And the investment side, we don't have. We don't know how long those clients have been there, how long they were likely to stay. But you know, if you're 25 or 30 years with a life company, you got a 90% persistency, we know that's a good quality of the business. So we factor it in. Yeah.
Just a little math here. What is your N sub 1 represent?
It's just an unknown period of time. It's just from, it actually goes out into perpetuity, all right? Because we could value, the other way to value a practice, it's called the discounted cash flow model. The other way to value a practice is, the ways you would value businesses have to do with, current value of assets and all that sort of stuff. But that doesn't apply in our business because we don't have assets other than clients.
You say this looks like a projection formulation.
It is.
Or a discount
sort. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the risk values when we institute in smaller?
What's the risk factor?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a percentage, and as I just said, it's a percentage that's based, and it's a totally subjective calculation.
Right? 4%, 6%, is it based on?
Could be 40%.
Huh?
Could be 40%.
Wow.
Yeah. In a very risky practice. Now, again, in the life business, we look at about 50 factors that contribute to the risk of a business, and then we assign and they usually run. We have what we call the market risk and then the practice risk. So the market risk is some reflection of the risk-free rate of return plus the market risk of investing in small micro-cap businesses and so on. So that might run 8 or 10%, and then the specific risk, depending on the practice, could run from 10 to 40%, 10 to 30, and we add those two together. So we could be discounting the cash flow at 25 to 40% sometimes.
Which seems quite high, but is that
Yeah, if you actually do the numbers on it, because what we're doing, because we're projecting this into perpetuity, all right, we add back in an expected growth rate. So if we expect that the markets are going to grow by 6%, that's going to reduce the risk factor and so on. I could show you some calculations if you want.
Sure.
Oh, all right. We're in a hurry then. All right, but that's what it is. But here's what I can tell you in our 5 minutes that we have remaining. All right, is that really it's future profitability is the only thing that determines current value. All right, and future profitability is what the practice will earn going forward. I mean, I'm interested in how it did up to this point, but as a buyer, I'm interested in what it's going to do for me. All right, so I'm only interested in the future profitability. Cash flow is king. The best gauge of future profitability is what we refer to as discretionary cash flow. All right, and discretionary cash flow is all the money that's left after you run the business, pay the expenses running the business, and pay yourself a fair compensation for your role as an advisor. All right, most people don't realize advisors get paid in two ways. Right? You get paid once for being an advisor and once as the owner of your business. Now, in the beginning, you only get paid for being an advisor because you haven't built any enterprise value. But as time goes on, as your business starts to come from referrals, as you start to build reputation and brand and automatic increases in assets under management or insurance in force or whatever it is, right? An increasing part of your compensation comes from your role as the owner of the business. So the discretionary cash flow is really equal to that owner compensation. All right? But again, because in most cases we actually take all the money and we don't differentiate between owner and advisor compensation, when we're doing evaluation, we will assign a value. All right, so we've got some numbers that came out of the Financial Planning Association, Moss Adams Study of Financial Advisory Practices, and we know that the value of the advisor's job, if you had to hire somebody else to do it, typically runs from about $100,000 to $350,000 a year. So if the practice is generating $800,000 of profit, all right, we know that, revenue after expenses except advisor compensation, then we would look at the nature of the job. Complex wealth management, higher, simple mutual fund sales, lower, so on. And we would subtract that and we'd say that is the discretionary cash flow that's left. That's what you're selling. All right, and there's a trade-off between risk and reward. The more certainty there is around that future cash flow, the higher the valuation, of course. There is both a science and an art. Objectively, we crunch the numbers. Subjectively, we look at all those qualitative aspects. Age of clients, mix of business, average size account, all of those types of things. And then this is a phrase out of my first book, which was all about asset allocation. And my investment advice to advisors then was, you're far better off to be approximately right than precisely wrong. All right? And the same thing happens when we're valuing practices. So when we value a practice, we'll say this practice is worth between this and this. It gives scope for the negotiation, but it also recognizes this principle. And then finally, at the end of the day, the value is in the eye of the beholder. It does not matter what I say the practice is worth. It's what the buyer and the seller agree they're going to exchange for. So how do you increase the risk or increase the value and decrease the risk? Bring more money in. That's one way. Increase the percentage of revenue that's on a recurring basis. Accurately record your financial position. Most advisors, when I ask them for their financial statements, what do I get? Their income tax return, right? Because they don't have really good financial statements. What is the sole purpose of an income tax return? It is to show the least amount of revenue and the least amount of profit. When you're trying to sell your business, what do you want to show? The most amount of revenue and the most amount of profit. So they're backwards. So you've got to record it accurately. I'm not saying two sets of books, but you got to have things in there. We've seen nannies on the payroll. We've seen kids on the payroll. We've seen all kinds of things. Best one I ever saw, I was on a balance sheet that an advisor gave me. And it said, Northern Office, client service vehicle, bracket, marine.
Right? How many boats?
Yeah, how many boats do you have there, sir? Have documented systems and processes in place. Have a strong compliance culture. Show that you've got a marketing plan. Have a diversified client base. And then this last one, promote the team versus the star. If you are this big man in town, you're the star of the business, there's a real risk when you walk out that business will not be worth much. So do what you can to transfer your goodwill over to the corporate goodwill. All right, so here's fact or fiction, my last one from this morning. Always think about how to maximize the value of your practice even if you have no plan to sell. And that is absolutely true. So here's what I say. Run your business as if it's going to last forever so that it can be sold at any time for the highest price to the most qualified buyer, because we just don't know when one of those big D's is going to come along that I referenced earlier today. All right, final thing, and this is the way most practices grow, right? It's the way most products evolve. In fact, it's the way most personal relationships evolve. Start off at the beginning, can get a little rocky, gets a period of growth, eventually reaches the level of complexity, starts to plateau or maturity. One of two things will happen. You'll do nothing, and you run the risk of dying a very slow and painful death. Well, you won't really die, but you'll miss some opportunities. All right, the alternative is to reinvent the business in some way and take it to a higher level. How do we do that? First, recognize that what got you there won't likely get you to the next level. You start a new growth curve, all right, and you overlay it on top of the other one. And that period in between, when those two curves are overlapped, is when you can reinvent your business. The problem is, the real challenge is you got to start over here before it starts to plateau, before it starts to decline. Most of the phone calls that I get come over here when it's already started to decline. All right? Doesn't mean it can't be salvaged. It just means it's a lot more work. Now, relate this to succession planning. Same sort of thing, except that this period inside, instead of being the succession plan, the reinvention zone, is the succession planning zone. All right? And you take the last period of your career and use it to maximize the value of your business. And so that ultimately, when you do transition out, you have maximum benefit coming from your life's work. How do you do that? Well, you start over there, first of all. But here's what I think is the most underlooked and undervalued opportunity that's out there. The whole industry now is talking about decumulation and becoming a retirement income specialist because people have accumulated all this wealth and now they need it out. I think there's an equally big and probably bigger opportunity for you to become an advisor, a coach, a mentor to your business owner clients around their own succession plan. All right, and the best way to do that, of course, is to go through it yourself. So if you do your own succession plan, got the same issues, you'll be able to do that. And think about it. If you have 10 clients who collectively are going to sell their business as a result of the work you did with them for a total enterprise value of $100 million, and you're transitioning your practice to Michael, you can say, Michael, look, in the next 10 years, there's another $100 million coming into this practice because we've already got agreement. We're going to manage the money. Would you pay more for that? Yeah, of course you would. All right? It's a great way to finish your career. So, your life, your legacy, it's worth doing. Don't let fate decide. Never too soon to start. And the rewards are great.